Welcome back to Wellness in Dentistry. I am one of your hosts, Dr. Kyle Stanley, and I'm here with your other host, Dr. Martin Mendelson. Hey, Martin.
Well, good day to you. I'm super excited. We now match. You
That's
notice
right. Yes. The
that?
black shirt crew. Here we are.
Yes. Yes.
Today is an interesting topic. I think this topic really goes against the status quo that so many practice management gurus are telling you, which is the answer to your problems is having more patients. I mean, you see people talk about this too, right?
Yep, all the time. All the time. And it drives me crazy because for a whole host of reasons, which we'll get into, but there are so many small levers that you can pull that can make massive differences to your practice. Because it may be small levers per patient, but it then adds up exponentially across the
Right.
totality of your practice.
That's right. Yeah. So just introducing this topic, how I've always taught this from a mental wellness standpoint in dentistry is that you don't need more patients necessarily. You need more of the right patients, or you just need the right patients. I think the answer to some of our colleagues' problems from a wellness standpoint, stress, litigation, is really dismissing patients, getting
Yes.
rid of these patients that show up late, are rude to your team, don't want to pay for radiographs, don't want to pay for exams, don't do any of your treatment plans. And we've kind of just been taught to bend over backwards and do whatever we can to keep these people and oh, well, yeah, next time we'll do this. And, oh, you've been late three times, but that's okay. And I'm sick of that, to be
Yeah.
honest with you. Like
Yeah.
many years ago, my partner Matt Najad and I made this pact basically where we're just like, listen, this is our business. This is our career. We run private businesses. We can decide who we want here and who we don't. And
Absolutely.
it completely changed our stress. Because we started getting rid of people.
Absolutely. And the phrase soar with eagles, don't flock with turkeys. And so there's such a thrust on getting Google reviews these days, which I agree and I'm aligned with, but there's another side of that, which is if you have Mr. or Mrs. Jones that you absolutely love because of who the kind of person they are, talk to them. Sit down and say, Mrs. Jones, I so love seeing you, having had the honor to treat you because you're so open. We have a true relationship between clinician and patient. I would love to treat more individuals like you. So if there's anybody in your life that you feel is aligned like you are in terms of what you're looking for in a dentist, it would really be our honor to help serve them as well. And so it's just so important to identify who those great people are, just like as important as it is, as you just said, to bounce the people that drive you crazy, show up late, stress out your staff. We don't need this. And we have to take a step back and understand and respect. If you're just starting out, if you're a scratch practice, if you're an associate, there is a great financial stress and financial burden,
For sure, yeah.
which I completely respect. What I would ask people to consider is what the cost is of putting up with this stuff. Because if they show up late, now your whole day's running late, right? So there's a cost to that. We refuse to acknowledge it, but there's a cost to that. So what's the cost of running late and having all these challenges versus on most days, if you can, running on time and being able to serve people to the best of your ability?
Yeah, you bring up a good point, which is asking for referrals.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is the times that I have done that, and I've done this many times, you get interesting responses.
Yeah.
I think one of the most surprising responses that you get is, oh, I didn't know that you're taking new patients.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like almost every dentist is taking new patients, right?
Yeah.
But patients think like, oh, I didn't know that you have any room for more people.
Exactly. Exactly.
And they may have friends or family, but they're like, oh yeah, I don't really know if he or she's taking any new patients.
Yeah.
So it's funny that you get these patients that don't realize kind of how a dental office works. And
Yeah.
most of us could handle a little more capacity.
Sure. It's a funny story that's just happened the other week. So the dentist I go to, that's also a personal friend, Bjorn Melander here in Scottsdale, the last time I was in, he looked at me and he goes, "By the way, we are looking at our referral sources." He said, "Do you know how many patients you've referred to me over the years?" And I said, No, he said 58. I said,
Oh my
holy smokes.
gosh.
But see, here's why I bring this up. I think about who I refer to him. I don't refer everybody to him. If it's somebody that I'm interacting with that I think is a great person, but I also think it's going to be a challenge, I don't refer them over. And so that kind of goes back to my earlier point, which is ask for the personal referral with discretion. Think about who you're asking. Don't just ask everybody, but ask, those genuine people, those appreciative people, the people you get along with, because people typically flock with similar types of people.
Yeah. So let's go a little bit into not putting up with crap from, to put it lightly, from patients. You know, people that go through, our courses together, our courses individually. We hear this all the time that, well, yeah, the patient comes late, but, they have treatment to do and I really need them. And I think it really all boils down to a lot of things, like things that we talk about in my LifeSide course, which is expectations, boundaries, and communications. Communication, excuse me. And one of those is just like communicating to the people that this is not okay.
I think, as you know, I agree with everything you just said. And what I'm going to add too is that there takes a bit of life experience and maturity to really embrace that. And when I
Yes.
work with my clients or teams, one of my favorite phrases I learned very early in my coaching career is, how true is that? So it's reality testing, if you want to use a catchphrase from emotional intelligence assessments, testing reality. Will I really need them? Well, how true is that? Well, they come in late, they've said no to XYZ treatment plans. Look, and I say this when I teach, when I talk numbers, I never want people for a minute to think that I'm numbers driven as it relates to a dental practice. But in the immortal words of MTS Manji, dental practice is 51% clinical, 49% business. Because if you're not looking out for the business, you're not going to be able to provide excellent clinical care. So we really need to look at these situations and these people. And sometimes, yes, we need to look at them based upon numbers to ascertain, is this person really helping us to support our mission, which is to provide great dentistry to the community? And if the answer is no, by starting with the simple question, how true is that? Then we end up stumbling upon the answer for ourselves. And it takes a bit of courage to be able to get there. But I think we're both here to say to everybody, you got this and you can do this. And it is okay to say no to people. And I'd be curious to get your input on this because a lot of times people are afraid, well, if I tell them I don't want to see them anymore, they're going to tell their friends. Well, who do you think they hang out with?
It's so true. Oh, it's so true. Yeah, all their friends are annoying too because they think it's okay to do everything that they're doing. Yeah, no, that's so right. Like we've had patients in our practice that we ended up dismissing after a long time though. Not really. This is before we made this pact to really start owning our own practice and making our own decisions and, making sure that we are going to set our own destiny and not just doing whatever is best for the patient. You know, the patient's always right. The patient's not always right. Like, this is our house. I have a friend that's a prosthodontist that practiced. He now practices in the US, but he used to practice in the UK. He treated the royal family. He treated like, the biggest soccer stars over there. And he told me, like, I tell these people when they have to be here, when to keep their mouth open, because nobody else, everyone else does whatever they want. And he said, you should see these people love me. They respect me. They show up on time. I tell them if you're not on time, I'm not going to see you. And it's crazy to think like you're coming to all these celebrities and royalty and telling them what to do. And he's like, yeah, this is my house. When they're here, they're in my house. When they're somewhere else, they can do whatever they want. But when they're here, they're going to behave a certain way.
Absolutely. Whether it's celebrities or royal family or just wealthy people in our community. I mean, most dental practices have people of note in their community. And so it may not be the Queen of England or some soccer star, but that psychological fear is still there because they're a prominent attorney or they're a prominent
Yes,
physician or that kind of
right.
thing. And you're making me think, the guy who took all my headshots is just a personal friend, and he happens to be this A-list Hollywood photographer. You go to his website and it's like Jodie Foster and Timothy Chalamet and Matt Damon and blah, blah, blah. So when he was taking my headshots, I said to him, I said, "What's the biggest lesson you learned about interacting with celebrities?" Which it goes to what you said. And his answer was, "Treat them like another human being and never ask them a question that a fan would ask them." So people of note, when they're in that kind of situation, they appreciate just kind of treating them like another human being. And we have a job to do. And, I love how you talk in your Lightside course about, how challenging it is, and we're working through a Cheerio and all the working environment of fear, all these amazing things that people can learn in your course. And the truth of the matter is, back to what we started saying earlier, if they're going to be that reticent and a you know what, then they need to go, because we have a job to do. And I think for so many of us, me included, we've allowed some patients to kind of rule the roost, which ends up becoming at the detriment of the care that we're able to provide.
Well, and let's talk about a little bit how it not only affects us too. I mean, we've had team members that have left because of patients that we didn't dismiss.
100%.
You know, it's not just us that suffers, our team, they hate when those patients come in. It ruins their entire day. They look on the schedule and they go, "Oh my gosh, John's coming in." And then we have Jennifer right after that. Oh, the two of them, they're, you know, John's always late. He says disgusting things to the girls at the front. You know, Jennifer comes in. She always complains about paying for an exam. She doesn't think she should have to pay for an exam. She never wants to take x-rays. You know, we've had that crown treatment planned on the lower molar for 3 years. She still says, "Oh, I don't know, I'm gonna do it. The buckle's broken off." Like, these patients cause stress to everybody. And especially now at a, you know, the current time that we're recording this, staff is a crazy subject right now. I mean, nobody can find the right team members, and you know, we see a lot of that, we hear a lot of that. Everybody's too expensive. So thinking about how these I call them problem patients, but these problem patients not only affect you, but affect your staff.
Absolutely. And what would it be like for people to consider that? Look, Rome wasn't built in a day. And so, what would it be like to consider that, okay, we're going to develop over the next month a messaging to our patients that's on our website. Maybe even we do a video. Video is easy to produce these days, where it's like, we welcome you into our practice. This is a partnership. We are going to do the best we can for you. And we have certain expectations to allow us to be able to do the best that we can. And, that has to do with, being on time and being compliant and all the things. And that, when these things are in line, we have great relationships with the people in our community, and we're not necessarily the dental office for everyone. And so when you establish that up front, like in any relationship, setting boundaries, then at least you have something to go back to. But if you never talk about it, and you know what they say about people who assume, and you just assume that people understand this, well, good luck with that, because that's just not the way life works. But in any relationship, if you can establish that, let's call it working relationship from the beginning, then at least you have something to go back to.
Yeah, you said something that I had to learn, I think, the hard way, which was every patient that comes in my practice may not be right for my practice. So, for example, my practice is very particular in the sense that we're high end, so we're expensive. I mean, there's 52 dentists in my building and we're the most expensive. Okay, so they could literally walk out the door and walk 4 feet across the hallway and be treated by a dentist that's probably half the cost. We take a lot of time. I mean, it kind of goes with the being expensive part. We only see one patient at a time. If you want to come in, you want to get your veneers done fast, you want it to be less expensive, we're not the right people for you. But if you want to come in, you want the highest quality treatment that you can get. We believe, you know, we use Rubberdam, we use guided surgery, we do digital smile design, everything like this, biomimetic dentistry. And you're willing to pay for that, and you're willing to take the time, because we tell people, you know, like, for example, when my partner Matt Najad is doing veneers, he's like a veneer master. You know, you may sit down for 4 or 5 hours. Other people may do it in an hour.
100%, 100%.
But
And
it's because we've got rubber dam and we're doing the bonding techniques, and all that takes more time.
absolutely.
And I also had to learn that there's some people, with our practice and with me as a person, I like things that I will pay more for if they last longer. Like you've seen my leather bags that I have, right?
Yes, they're
They're
beautiful.
expensive, but they have a 100-year warranty. Like I like nice cars that last long and like are real quality made. That's just like a, I don't know, it's a little quirk that I have. I had to realize there's some people that kind of don't care about that. And they're like, oh, well, if it breaks in a few years, I'll just get it done again.
Absolutely. And what you're also saying also goes to filtering. And so when the patient initially calls, one of my most, I have so many favorite things that Frank Spear does, but one of which is when he talks about filtering relative to what do you do when a patient calls and says, how much is a crown? And Spear has this whole framework about how to do that, but he goes through this conversation about, well, it depends. It's really hard for us to give you an answer. There's crowns in the front, crowns in the back, different materials, different situations. So we really need to see you to be able to evaluate you effectively to be able to give you an answer. And I can share with you one additional thing. If you're looking for the lowest cost dentist in our community, we're not the office for you. And it's amazing how well that works because you're setting the boundary up front.
Yep, setting the expectation
And you're
too.
filtering out the people that are just there for price, not necessarily there for quality and being treated differently than perhaps another dentist down the street.
Yeah, I think there's practice management gurus that talk a lot about like just get them in. Just get them in, and you can kind of convince them to do whatever you want. And I think from a wellness standpoint, from like a mental fitness standpoint, I don't think that's the right way to do it.
No,
Because
I would
it's like
agree.
this. I always relate it to this. Like, I would love to buy a Ferrari, okay? But I can't afford a Ferrari. So don't like, oh, just get me in and you'll convince me. I can't afford it. Okay? Like, there's going to be people that can't afford your practice, let's say if you're on the higher end or whatever. So don't get them in and convince them to like, drown their 401k to do this or something. Like they can't afford it.
And you bring up an interesting point too. I mean, yes, and the flip side's also true for the patients that are really interested, that really want to do it, and they feel like they can't afford it. There's so many avenues out there for people to be able to, engage in financing. I mean, CareCredit talks about this all the time. That blows my mind. They're in somewhere on the order of 90% of dental offices, but the utilization is far below that. And so people get into these habits, ourselves and our teams, of making judgments of people whether they can or cannot afford it by the way they present themselves or the way they're dressed, et cetera, which is can really get you into trouble. And so just giving people the opportunity without judgment to say, okay, so it sounds like you really want to do this. We do have other avenues to explore for you to be able to get this accomplished. What do you think about that? Asking these open-ended questions, not assuming and closing the conversation down, can really bring practices forward as well. So.
With me realizing that not every patient was right for my practice was very freeing for me. Especially with one thing you and I have talked about a lot is these, I call them binder patients. Okay, so I have a binder rule in my practice that if a patient comes in with a binder from the previous four, five, six, eight, 10 dentists that hasn't been able to treat their problem, I'm not going to be the 10th dentist that's finally going to treat it. And the naive Kyle, when I was first out of school, let's say the first 7 years of practice, didn't realize that. So I was like, ego is huge, thinking, well, that's just because they didn't have the training that I had. They didn't have the mentors that I have. They're not doing biomedical dentistry. They're not doing guided surgery. It's because they didn't use rubber dam. It's because they didn't do this, this, this. I had to realize that it wasn't the dentist. It was the patient.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
everybody is like sticking up for the patient in this case. And I get where it's coming from because we love to solve problems. We love to help people. You know, I love when a patient comes in and has like a bad experience with a dentist, and I can be the good experience, change them around, you know. But I got tricked into a lot of these patients. You know, they come in saying, you know, they've been in temporaries for 2 years. And they've gone to three different dentists and nobody can get it. And I think, well, you know, we're going to be the ones to do it. And these are the patients that extort you, sue you, you know, write bad reviews, cause a ruckus in the front office when there's other people there.
I think this goes to something I talk about that we've talked about too a lot is this idea of dental dualism, the idea that we think that, all we need to do is focus on clinical and practice management stuff and we'll have a successful practice. What I now have seen from my own personal as well as experience of working with thousands of offices is that people are people. And you have to embrace the motivating factors of people. And if somebody comes in and your spidey sense is going off, or like the kind of example you gave with the binder, you're not gonna save the world. You can't treat everybody anyway. That's not humanly possible. So stop trying to do so and stop trying to buck against humanistic traits, understand humanistic traits, learn how to communicate better, learn how to truly ask open-ended questions. Because I don't know about you, but my experience is most dentists know what an open-ended question is, but they don't know how to use it effectively. And so you can't win with everybody. And I have this in my coaching and facilitation practice as well. It's been very few, but I've had individuals that I've spent time with, an initial exploratory call. They want to move forward. We create all the contracts and all this stuff, and then I don't hear from them again. And do I get upset? No, I celebrate. Why? Because we weren't a good fit. And so if we can start to put that mindset around patient interactions and start looking for those red flags to create partnership with our patients, that creates a different day at the office.
One thing that I thought of as you were talking was the difficulty that I had, especially, was that I needed the money. You know, I got out of school with $500,000 in debt from USC. I, you know, was living in Los Angeles. And the part that tricked me about a lot of these patients, these kind of problem patients, they come with a lot of work that needs to be done. And many times they sound like the perfect patient. They have a lot of time. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of things, three things, you know, a lot of m things to do as well. So they have like this perfect trifecta of what you would want with a patient. But like you were saying, the partnership isn't there in the sense that like your personalities don't really mesh. Or, you know, if they've had all these problems with previous dentists, they're coming in with a lot of preconceived notions of who you are, right? So they're going to be kind of on edge about things that you do. And I've even had the opposite to where they hated all the previous dentists, but they come in and they loved me, or they loved, you know, my partner. And they're like, oh, well, you're the savior. And you're, oh my gosh, I know it's you. You're going to be able to do this. That inflates my ego. It makes me feel good. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to help these people. But I just have to realize that it's not it. Don't fall for the trap.
And I think part of the trap, well, let me rephrase. My belief is that the trap is subjective and psychological, not objective and quantifiable. And so if we were to really sit down and objectively look at this, we realize that we're spending more chair time, where it's taking longer per visit. It's precluding us from doing other things, which kind of leads in. I know we kind of wanted to get into the whole referral discussion. Because that's a big deal too, relative to feeling financial pressures and, feeling like you need to do it all. And so if you can analyze the true cost of doing everything, I mean, I think endodontics is kind of a good example. If it takes you 3 hours to do molar endo, why are you doing that? It's so inefficient. Where you could actually be treating other people in restorative procedures, or if you're trying to take out wisdom teeth, or you haven't had adequate training in implants and all this kind of stuff, it's like, what are you doing? It sounds good on the front end, but if you analyze it, what you realize is financially, it's costing you because it's taking you so much longer.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, which is these patients, these problem patients, you don't get to do good treatment on them. And even if you do, let's say your treatment is sound, right? Your margin is good, your implant is great, you usually don't make money on them because either you or your assistant or your hygienist or your front office team member is always on the phone with these people, or they're showing up late, they're bleeding over into other time. And even on these big cases, you may think like, well, I'm doing a full mouth of rehabilitation on these people. I'm charging $30,000, 50, 60, whatever it is you charge in your practice. If you looked at the per hour, or even think of per hour as what you're thinking about them at home too, because these are the patients that keep you up at night. Like,
Amen.
oh my gosh, the crown came off, or the whatever, the tooth I prep turned into an endo. Like, how much time are you putting in, even not in the practice? Another thing that you brought up was thinking that you have to do everything. And I was like this because, with my training, which is kind of this perioperosteal training, I had the ability to really do everything, right? I chose not to do endo just because I didn't like it and I wasn't very good at it, but really almost everything else I could do, from wisdom teeth to implants to veneers to inlays and onlays. I realized after doing that for about 6 years, I realized that I wasn't very efficient at like restorative dentistry on teeth as I was with implants. And when my partner Matt came to me and said, Kyle, you've told me you don't really like doing crowns, like, maybe you should just not do it and I'll just do them. And at first I was kind of like offended, like, what do you mean? Like, well, I'm a dentist, I can do crowns, right? But in the long run, he knew it was so much better for me. And I even had a friend of mine called Matt Koepke is his name. He was an oral surgeon. And I don't know if I've ever introduced you to Matt, really amazing guy. But
Yeah, he's been on some of our light side
oh,
coaching.
that's right. He was a light. Yeah, he was
He's
on
cool.
Lightside Academy in our Lightside Club. That's right. Well, Matt is an oral surgeon, and traditional oral surgery, get out of school, you do wisdom teeth, implants, pathology, that kind of stuff. When he started looking at his time to finances, looking at how much time, how much money he's making, he realized, I don't really make much money off of implants. Maybe I should just do dental alveolar surgery, which is kind of crazy, right? Because everyone thinks like, oh, my implants, like that is the thing. But if you're taking way too much time, and you can make, let's say, $2,000 in 45 minutes from doing wisdom teeth and have no lab bill, have no components, all you're paying for is sutures and gauze and sterilizing instruments, like, that makes more sense. But that goes against the status quo. And I think there's so many of these things in dentistry that are the status quo, but cause so many problems with wellness in dentistry, whether that's for the patient, whether that's for the business, the practice, or that's for the practitioner.
I think it goes back to the question I offered everybody to live by, which is how true is that? If you're sitting there saying to yourself, I have to do this, well, how true is that? Well, who made that rule? Well, I need to do this be for financial reasons. How true is that? That may be true, but unless you sit down and run the numbers, let's call it what it is. You're kidding yourself because you're not looking at this analytically and you're making a pretty heavy decision, if you think about it, how to live your practice life based upon a subjective feeling versus objective data. And data is data and numbers don't lie. And depending on your DPMS system, some numbers are easier to generate than others. However, at the end of the day, if you take, let's say, even forward thinking, say, okay, I'm going to go over the next 3 months, I'm going to monitor what's going on in whatever element of the practice we were looking for. And then at the end of the 3 months, I'm going to sit back and evaluate it. And I'm going to go with what the numbers show me. And that kind of decision making is a very different story versus I have to do this or that's what my patients expect, et cetera. Because nobody made up those rules except for us between our ears.
Yeah, we in dentistry, it's funny how We're scientists. We're fact-driven. We love research. We love proof. But then in so many aspects of what we do, we just kind of go with whatever the status quo is, which, like you're saying, isn't necessarily fact-based in our practice. And I think once you get those facts, like this is why I was passionate about AI, is that it's fact-driven, you know? And I love that. Like anytime you have a fact that I can look at data, and maybe, you know, there's a negative connotation with like being a business-minded dentist, I think. You know, it's like I'm an artist, I'm a doctor, like running the business is the back part of it. I would challenge dentists, maybe don't think about it as numbers, think about it as data instead.
This is data that I'm evaluating to allow me to be able to provide better care to the human beings in my community. When you look
Amen.
at it that way, it's mission driven, not financially driven, because there's nothing wrong with looking to run or oversee a financially successful practice. And the truth of the matter is that there's lots of studies on this, and it's not just for dentistry. When you're so pent up and concerned about finances, it affects everything else about your life because it's so overpressing and such a big burden to you.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to the three-prong approach that we talk about with wellness, right? The patient has to have wellness, and that's doing the best treatment. That is the, like you're saying, mission-driven way of doing the best clinical dentistry that we can. You have to have the practice has to be well, right? Because that's what's supporting everybody. If we don't, if the business doesn't make money, we can't pay our overhead, we can't pay our team members, we can't pay for sutures and implants and hygienists. And then lastly, which of course is the one that we are really very passionate about, and I think where this the why this all came together was wellness for the practitioner. And I think what you find is when you have wellness for the patient, when you have wellness in your practice, those are what everyone else focuses on. They get that and they ignore that third prong. And what happens is everything else falls apart.
So you very well know that one of my favorite books is Atomic Habits by James Clear. And the reason why it's one of my favorite books is there's a paragraph within the first chapter where he talks about lagging indicators. And your net worth is a lagging indicator of financial habits. Your health is a lagging indicator of your fitness habits. And your financial success in dentistry is a lagging indicator of what you do on a daily basis. And so when we can focus on doing the right thing for patients to drive efficiency, to allow the provision of extraordinary care, that's a different mindset. And that creates a different situation that sets us up for success in ways that we could have never imagined when we look at it differently of, I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to take everybody. Do you? Who made that rule?
Now we do, to push back on that a little bit, we do know, and you and I both know a lot of dentists that are very financially successful, but very poor in their mental wellness,
Oh,
right?
100%. And let's also talk about the elephant in the room relative to insurance and taking let's call them what they really are, defined benefit plans. They're not insurance.
Discount plans, yeah.
Discount plans. So, there's contracts and there's contracts and some vary based upon where you are in the world and so forth. And so, at the end of the day, yes, there are certain contingencies that you need to follow, while at the same time, no, you don't have to treat everybody, right? And patients will self-select out. And I think it goes back to some of the things we were talking about earlier. If we can set up the relationship from day one, people who are interested in that are going to self-select in or self-select out, because let's call it what it is. If
Phrase.
you're taking a plan that's ubiquitous within the community and they're not aligned with what you're doing, they will go somewhere else. And the benefit of that is your mental health. And I don't know about you, but you can't put a price on that.
No, that's exactly right. Like, so many people would listen to what you just said and go, oh my gosh, but they're gonna go somewhere else.
So
Okay. I mean, like you were saying at the beginning, there are times when, you know, you may need to take more patients, like you're growing your practice, you're kind of learning these processes. But once you get to where you're kind of established, which, there's not a lot of dentists that are failing out there, right? There's dentists that are making more money, making less money,
Absolutely.
doing better treatment, doing less treatment, of course. But most dental practices are kind of self-sustaining.
Yep.
Losing 5 patients a year, 10 patients a year can be good, not
Absolutely.
bad,
Absolutely.
because you're either losing money on those patients or
Yeah.
they're driving you crazy to where
Absolutely.
you get home, you have nothing left for your family, for your kids, for your
Yeah.
neighbors.
Yeah.
And these people are driving you insane. And there's this thought that, like, oh my God, but what if they go somewhere else? It's like, great.
Yeah. And I encourage everybody listening too, if you don't know how to run these types of numerical evaluations, get some help. Seek out, a highly qualified consultant or a consultant group or et cetera, because I have so many friends that have gone fee for service that have left from the plans, and that was their own choice. And look, I'm not going to sit here and say one's better than the other because everybody's situation is different, right? But the truth of the matter is, in most cases, if you run the numbers based upon, I just lost the word in my head. If you run the numbers, most practice,
Reimbursement.
thank you. That was the word. You can lose about a third of the people that you currently treat and still be at the same place or more profitable because of the reimbursement levels. However, that's unique to every practice. And if you don't know how to run these numbers, or if you need, or if you feel the need to have these numbers double checked, hire somebody who's capable to do it. There's lots of wonderful people out there,
Yeah. Well, today has been a really great discussion, and I think it goes back against what the status quo is in dentistry, which is more patients, more patients, more patients. That's the answer. And that answer can be good for finances sometimes, but it can be detrimental for finances. And I think where we focus more is how does that affect the wellness of the practitioner? And that is
100%.
incorporating every aspect of how we treat our patients, how our business is doing, and how our mental wellness is.
And the truth of the matter is that what we're talking about is not fluff. If people want to take a look at the article I did for Dental Economics in January of 2024, I talk about how the science of optimism literally affects your visual cortex, affects your ability to process information, it affects your ability to treatment plan. When we're sitting there negatively primed, and by the way, I'm not sitting here saying we need to walk around with a smile on our face every day. I talk about that in the article, and the data is pretty scary, where small jolts of positivity by starting your day with a little bit of gratitude, or thinking about one study that blows my mind. What's your favorite movie you've ever seen, Kyle?
Gosh, I love Fight Club.
Okay, so you're thinking about Fight Club right now and how much you like it. Believe it or not, on average, your endorphins just got raised by about 27% just from that. And so the data is pretty scary. And this dental dualism that I talked about before is real. And the idea that our mind and body are separate is hogwash. And so
Yes.
focusing on your mental wellness will impact your clinical prowess and your practice success, period, hands down.
Yep. That's right. Well, thanks everybody for joining us for Wellness in Dentistry. If you're interested in anything that we do, you can go to the show notes below, or you can follow us on Instagram. I'm Dr. Kyle Stanley, and you can watch my free masterclass with some of my links. And Martin, for you.
Yeah, for me, I am on Instagram as Doc Martin Empowers. I'm also heavy into LinkedIn as well. I have a newsletter with almost 7,000 subscribers, and my website's super simple. It's just my name, martinmendelson.com.
All right, everyone, we'll see you next time.